WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Animal Week on Fresh Air, and today we have a parade of creatures that give you the creeps, starting with one of the creepiest of them all, the cockroach. We have an interview with former bug wrangler Dave Brody. Cockroaches in your home are never a welcome sight. In one film role, E.G. Marshall had a real problem.
Once you get bugs, you never get rid of them. Breed in the crawl spaces, in the conduits, in the very core of the building itself.
In the film Creepshow, E.G. Marshall played a millionaire Howard Hughes-type hermit whose germ-free penthouse was mysteriously infested by cockroaches. These roaches were supplied and handled by entomologist Dave Brody. In Hollywood parlance, he was known as a bug wrangler. In the film The Believers, he worked with tarantulas and centipedes. But his tour de force was directing more than 20,000 cockroaches for Creepshow. Brody is now the senior museum technician in the Department of Entomology at the Museum of Natural History in New York. In 1987, I asked him how he rounded up the Creepshow roaches, including 2,000 giant roaches from Trinidad.
I made some calls to Washington, and I found out that if I was very careful, I can import the giant cave roach from Trinidad. They flew us to Trinidad, and you would sit on the floor of the cave, and the cave floor was covered in bat guano, bat droppings. Now, because the cave was dry, these droppings had the consistency of coffee beans. You would sit down on the floor with your legs crossed, and the ground, the coffee beans would undulate because beneath them were the roaches. And we got about two-thirds of the roaches that we needed out of that. And then we went down to the lower cave, and that was a very wet cave, very disturbing cave because it was narrow and constricting. And there was one point within that cave where you really had to wiggle through. And that's when the bats left that cave, they made a slight drop in their flight path, and that's where they defecated. So you had water dripping there. Now, coming out of the cave after collecting the roaches, my hand sort of slipped into that morass. And I wanted to amputate my hand at that point. It was very, very unpleasant.
The name that you're given when you work on a movie is Roach Wrangler or Tarantula Wrangler.
Mm-hmm.
Why is the word wrangler used for
That's a movie term. Horse wranglers, cow wranglers, and it sort of just trickled down. But I think it's a good term. I think it's exactly what we do.
How do you control roaches on a set? If they're actors, you tell them what their positions are, and you yell positions, and everything's all set. How do the roaches know where their positions are?
You build corrals for them, and you give the impression that they're doing things. And you can get them to move in directions by air current, by light. The very things that govern their lives, essentially, is how we use them. The scenes where they're coming up out of the sink were done with giant plastic syringes, and we just sort of pumped them in. My favorite scene in that movie was, of course, the bed scene, when he flips the covers off the bed, and the whole bed is just covered with a mass of undulating roaches. I thought that was just really terrific.
Mm. One of my concerns would be, if I were doing a movie like this, is what happens to the roaches after the shoot? You have 22,000 roaches running around a set. I mean, who'd want 22,000 roaches, not only in the set, but added to the city that it's being filmed in? Is there any way to ensure that you can gather them all up and control them when you're finished?
Well, the government regulations that I had with the permit stated that all the imported roaches had to be frozen and then burned, which is what we did. It was a wonderful job, by the way. It wasn't one that I was particularly happy to do. I don't like to kill animals. I really don't. But it was the only way. We just had too many of them to deal with.
Are there any ethical questions that you run into in your line of work, since you must get asked to do very unusual things with insects?
In my mind, I don't like to kill any insect unless I absolutely have to. And frequently, I did a shoot just with live bees recently, and I returned those bees to the wild. And I did The Believers, and there was a scene in The Believers where I had to pick up a live centipede and run a pin through it. And I had a very hard time deciding whether I would do it. And I finally did a little bit of research into the anatomy of the insect and the physiology of the insect. It's not an insect, I'm sorry, it's an arachnid. And I decided that I could do it and the animal would survive. And I did it. And as a matter of fact, we had to do that take twice, and the animal is still alive at the museum, in my office at the museum. So the research there paid off. But I don't think I would do it again. I really don't. It really disturbed me. I mean, the scene was dynamite in the movie. It was a very nice scene, but it really bothered me to do it.
What bothers you is the thought of torturing insects.
That's right. I don't like to do that at all.
Well, one of the most shocking moments in recent entertainment television was when the magicians Penn and Teller appeared on the David Letterman show, and Letterman said, I want you to really surprise me. So Teller put his magician's hat on Letterman's desk, then lifted it up a little bit later to reveal hundreds of roaches, which immediately took over Letterman's desk. Letterman was absolutely horrified, or at least that's how
he sure was.
He appeared to be. Now, you were the wrangler that Penn and Teller used to get those roaches. When they called you up and asked you to surprise David Letterman live on television, what did you think of the idea?
Well, it was a matter of getting Penn and Teller to learn to handle the insects. And they did that pretty well. When it came to the final roundup, they just pitched in and helped. They helped me scoop them up, which says a lot for Penn and Teller. And we got them all back except for one, which showed up the next night when Julia Child was doing some cooking, I understand. I thought that was rather amusing.
Dave Brody is senior museum technician in the Department of Entomology at the Museum of Natural History in New York. We spoke in 1987. When ants are marching across your kitchen or taking over your picnic lunch, it's unlikely that you'll pause to reflect on what fascinating creatures they are. Maybe this is a better time. Before we meet one of the world's foremost ant experts, let's hear an ant's point of view as expressed by Woody Allen in the animated film Ants.
You know, my mother never had time for me. You know, when you're the middle child in a family of 5 million, you don't get any attention. I mean, how is it possible? And I've always had these abandonment issues which plagued me. My father was basically a drone, like I've said, and, you know, the guy flew away when I was just a larva. And my job, don't get me started on, because it really annoys me. I was not cut out to be a worker, I'll tell you right now. I feel physically inadequate. My whole life, I've never been able to lift more than 10 times my own body weight. And when you get down to it, handling dirt is not my idea of a rewarding career. It's this whole gung-ho superorganism thing that I can't get. I try, but I don't get it. I mean, you know, what is it? I'm supposed to do everything for the colony, and what about my needs? What about me?
Woody Allen from the film Ants. Edward O. Wilson knows all about ants. He won his second Pulitzer Prize for his 1990 book, The Ants. Wilson is a professor at Harvard, an honorary curator in entomology at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. I spoke to him in 1994 after the publication of Journey to the Ants. In your new book, Journey to the Ants, you have these fantastic blown-up photographs of ants. This is how ants look, I guess, under a microscope, you know, if you enlarge them thousands of times. And in these enlarged photographs, the ants look a lot, to me anyways, like dinosaurs. They have dinosaur-type faces, and their little antennae look like horns coming out of the head. They look quite prehistoric to me. And in fact, the ants date back to the dinosaur era. So is that why they look the way they do?
Well, it's not their great age. I think it's the fact that they have external skeletons. We are typical mammals in that we have an internal skeleton, and our tissues right out to our thin, soft skin are added like padding onto that internal skeletal structure. But insects, including ants, have it the other way around. They have their skeleton on the outside, and they have all that soft tissue on the inside. And having the hard body parts on the outside means that they build spines and plates and horns and medieval armor-like joints all over the body that does give them that dinosaur look. In fact, they're much more extreme in that regard than are dinosaurs.
I want to see ants a little more through your eyes. A lot of people see ants as just, you know, pests that attack your food when you're on a picnic or that infest your house, much to your dismay. What do the ants do that are wonderful within the larger ecosystem?
Let me introduce that by telling you the answer to the question that I most often ask about ants, and that is, what do I do about the ones in my kitchen? And my answer is always the same. Watch where you step. Be careful of little lives. Put down a little bit of cookie crumbs for them, maybe a touch of whipped cream. They like that too. And watch them for a while, and you will see a world that is as different from our own as can be imagined. It is a world of the kind that one might expect if life had been found on Mars, or as we may indeed find it on some other planet. Ants belong to an evolutionary line that diverged from our own half a billion years ago, and they achieved numerous adaptations to the world, including their social organization in a way that's radically different from our own. So look at them as inhabitants, if you will, as another planet. And this difference includes, to come quickly to the point of what I see in them as a scientist who works on them, includes their near total reliance on chemical communication. And here they are really radically different from us. We are audio-visual creatures. We should realize that our dependence on sound and sight to get through the world and to communicate with one another is really rather exceptional in the animal world, and the ants are much more typical in being chemical. That is to say, they release substances, chemicals, secretions from all over their bodies. They have special glands for this purpose that then they pass back and forth. They taste, they smell, and it is with different chemicals that they actually are able to communicate with one another rapidly and in a sophisticated manner. For example, there are chemicals they release to alarm one another, saying, there is an enemy near.
My guest is entomologist E.O. Wilson. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about ants with entomologist Edward O. Wilson. You did an experiment on the chemical an ant gives off when the ant has died that communicates to the other ants that the ant is dead and needs to be carried out of the ant nest. Tell us about the experiment.
When an ant dies, it, just like any other dead thing, it crumples up. It may be lying on its back, but it's not noticed by the other ants rushing by it inside the nest as we would notice it, because we're visual. And the ants in the nest wait until the corpse begins to decay. And after 2 or 3 days, it's full of substances that you find in a corpse. All of these unpleasant things like trimethylamine and skatole and fatty acids and so on. And it occurred to me, we're talking back in the 50s during the early days of working out the chemical language of ants, it occurred to me that ants, probably having small brains, not being able to process very much information, depended not on all that array of charnel house smells, but probably zeroed in on a distinctive smell, and so it proved. I got this in synthetic form, many of the chemicals that are found in corpses. My laboratory was unbearable to visitors for weeks during those experiments, and I tried them one out after the other on ants that I had in the laboratory, and finally hit upon the astonishing discovery that indeed ants identify a corpse with oleic acid. When you daub oleic acid, pure oleic acid, on a piece of paper or a live ant from that nest, it's treated as a corpse, and I amused myself and students for years afterward by putting oleic acid on live ants and watching them be picked up by their nestmates and is carried out and dumped on the refuse pile where corpses are placed. And then the ants had to, of course, pick themselves up and try to clean themselves off and get back into work inside the nest. But if they didn't get enough of that oleic acid off, they would be picked up and dumped in the corpse pile again. And this kept on until finally they got clean enough to rejoin the living. That's sort of the night of the living dead.
No, were you able to analyze whether the living dead ants could do anything to protest being carried off?
Nothing whatsoever, because you see, there's nothing in the natural world that adds something like oleic acid to the body of ants. And ants are magnificently programmed to do certain things with great efficiency and speed, but there are many things they're not programmed to do because there's never been any occasion in their evolution for them to do it. And therefore, you can play tricks on ants. One of my favorite is to take a trail substance, which I first discovered back in the late 50s, in different kinds of ants. These are the substances that the ants lay down from particular glands in the rear part of their body. And the worker going outside the nest and finds a piece of food or a good place to build a new nest will lay a trail consisting of the material from that gland back to the nest. So once I discovered what that substance was and the gland was coming from, then I could bring the ants out anytime I wanted and take them anywhere I wanted. And in one extreme experiment I did, I led a group of slave-making ants. These are ants that specialize on enslaving other kinds of ants and living off their labor. And I actually brought out armies of slave-making ants and had them milling around at the end of my artificial trail in confusion, wondering where the war was, where the battle was. They were brought out, and they didn't have any colony to attack and enslave.
You can make yourself a cult leader in the ant world.
Yes, indeed. It's possible, I think, with 20 or 30 substances, the key ones that the ants use to communicate chemically with, to have complete mind control of an ant colony. Let that be a lesson to us.
Well, really, say instead of being a brilliant scientist, you had a sick and perverse mind. I mean, you could use these ants for all kinds of unusual purposes, no?
Well, probably not, because most ant colonies are really rather delicate constructions, and they may seem annoying and ineradicable when they're living in the walls of your house, but when you start altering them a little bit, put them in the wrong environment, or messing up their communication system with trials of the kind that I've conducted, then the colony falls apart rather quickly.
What would happen to the world if all the ants were to magically disappear?
Terrible things. Let me preface my response by saying that, of course, we will do everything in our power to save the human species. That is the entire meaning of our own lives. But if the human species were to disappear from the Earth would go on unperturbed. In fact, the ecosystems of the world would regain their previous equilibrium, and short of some great meteorite strike, the planet could count on another billion years or so of undisturbed evolution amidst great biological diversity. But if ants, these little despised creatures at our feet, were to disappear, because they are such vital parts of the ecosystem on which the turning of the soil and the removal of dead animals and the predation on the kind of animals and so on is vital, if they were removed, then we would see a partial collapse of the ecosystems on the land. Probably many thousands of other species would become extinct soon afterward. Many plants would go extinct and so on. There would be a major reorganization and a depauperization of the land ecosystems. The world would suffer if it lost an important group like the ants.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for the privilege.
Edward O. Wilson recorded in 1994 after the publication of his book Journey to the Ants. More creepy creatures in the second half of the show as Animal Week continues. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.